Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas, and throughout August, we'll be revisiting our books roundups from previous years to give you a chance once again to hear recommendations from our writers and editors on subjects like Marcel Proust's letters, tech-ensnared science fiction, and Euripides. In this episode, there's also an interview with the Man Booker International Prize winner of 2017, David Grossman, and his translator, Jessica Cohen. So today, we're skipping back to 2017's Books of the Year, and introducing what he called the not-quite-legendary TLS special is our then-editor, Stig Abel.
The way it works is that we, or rather Thea before she goes on holiday, asks trusted contributors either to recommend books we should be reading or tell us the books they will be reading over the summer. And we end up with a beautifully eclectic collection of titles, not all of which, it must be said, you'd expect to find at the sweaty end of a beach towel. So to help us discuss this and make our own recommendations, we're joined by two podcast regulars, Northern indie pop star and TLS arts editor Lucy Dallas.
Hello. Hello, I'm one of the pallid wrecks that you so gallantly referred to earlier on.
Exactly. And Eamon McBride, fanboy and TLS literary editor, Toby Lichtig.
Hello, I'm the other pallid wreck.
Well, I was including myself in the pallid wreck count.
Yeah. I've even been on holiday, so I have no excuse.
I know, but you don't like the sun, do you?
Well, I like the sun, it doesn't like me.
Yeah. Eamon is one of the contributors to our summer books list. I was pleased, and no doubt you were pleased to see.
I was pleased and excited
exactly.
to see you.
Toby has also interviewed the recent winner of the Man Booker International Prize, David Grossman. We'll be hearing that interview also in the programme. Right, so the way this podcast is going to break down, each of us is going to propose a TLS contributor whose holiday baggage we would most like to steal to take on our own holiday, reflecting only on the book content it would contain, of course. Later on, we'll make some recommendations and confessions of our own, which is always fun, as few people read fewer entire books than literary journalists, in my experience. So we'll be testing how much we all actually read. So, kick us off. Thea, you've had a holiday. Pretend, I'm sure you're probably going on another holiday almost in the next month or fortnight.
Well, yes, in fact, I am.
I was being facetious and you are. Okay, so who's holiday reading in the summer books list? But seeing as you're virtually a professional holiday goer yourself...
Well, that's why I orchestrated this whole feature, work out what to put into my suitcase.
Okay, so who would you recommend? Whose books would you steal?
Well, how could I not be intrigued by Ian Sansom's choice?
Go on.
He has chosen June Caldwell's first short story collection, Room Little Darker, which is published by New Island Books. He says it promises to do for the Irish short story what Jeremy Corbyn has done for the Labour Party, which to me means...
Yeah, take it to an extreme position.
It will probably be, yes, bold, divisive, a little bit confusing on the kind of broader sense, probably a good thing.
Do you think?
But I don't really know where she's going to stand on Europe.
You're tempted
I
by that?
I think I'm tempted by that one.
And then anything else he's taking? He's taken quite a lot.
He is. Well, all of our contributors seem to take quite a lot.
Yeah.
They?
He talks about Vic James's dystopian Gilded Cage, a vision of a Britain ruled by the skilled over the unskilled.
Yes. That does sound good.
Toby, have you ever heard of that?
I have not, no.
No. This is quite a test for you, actually.
Absolutely.
Is it? What percentage would you say, Toby, of these books have you actually heard of?
Heard of? Oh, 80,
all of them,
87.
80, 20.
Yeah. Most of them. Most
How many have we reviewed or in the process of review? Most of them.
I'd say most of them. Yeah. I mean, some of them aren't even new books, but yes, yeah, most. Certainly the novels.
But it's interesting he wants to take short stories on holiday. I wouldn't.
I like a nice novel.
But you're not a fan of the form.
I'm not. Would you take short stories? You would take short stories.
Well, I mean, I took David Saloy's, and that is interconnected short stories.
Although, obviously, it did make the shortlist for the Man Booker Prize, so it is technically a novel. But
any good?
I think it's fantastic. Yeah, yeah. I wish it had won the Booker. I loved it.
Agreed.
And you obviously
enjoyed that conversation over.
So you're
it's radio gold.
Can you disagree?
Yes, me too.
Can you disagree?
No, I haven't read it, so I can't have an opinion either way.
Fine, just pretend you don't like it, Lucy. No one else. Yeah. Lucy, go on. Whose holiday bag are you taking?
Well, I kind of feel I ought to take Jennifer Howard's because
I like the sound of Jennifer Howard.
Do like a bit of tech ensnared science fiction?
What's she taking?
She's taking William Gibson's The Peripheral, but I've never read a word of William Gibson, I'm afraid.
Have you not?
No.
Despite being a sci-fi fan?
Science fiction, as we call it.
That's what sci-fi stands for, surely.
You're not allowed to call it sci-fi? No, I don't think you
is
are.
That
but I can't remember who
also the
doesn't like
SF
to call it
SF is another one, isn't it?
I think
it?
SF is all right.
Is that okay?
And sci-fi is sort of demeaning. I don't know.
Is it?
I don't know.
But you've not read any William Gibson?
No, I haven't.
I had to review William Gibson for the TLS.
Gibson fan?
Back in the day. No, I found it really arch. Mm. And it was about a sort of strange thing about a brand being sort of a quest for a holy brand or something. It was very knowing. Mm. I had to review it with Ian M. Banks and someone, and China Mieville. So China Mieville's book was about a giant squid.
Yes, Kraken. It's an excellent book.
So you like that. Yes. And then Ian M. Banks was about these giant ships and planets like hell. And it was kind of all right. But I find science fiction baffling.
Well, also Kraken's not really science fiction.
What is it then? Fantasy?
Yeah, it's kind of, it's a kind of mixture of all sorts of
things. But you are a science fiction fan?
But I'm not an aficionado, so I'm not one of those people that's read all of Brian Aldiss and Asimov. I mean, I know who they are, but I haven't read it all.
So who's your sort of science fiction?
China Mieville.
Some of it is science fiction because that crazy bonkers one about language. Embassy Town.
He appears in this list somewhere, China Mieville, doesn't he?
Yes.
He's not the only person I've ever read.
You reviewed his most recent one for us.
I did. That wasn't science fiction either.
What was that then?
Bonkers. That was about an alternative Paris trapped in a loop in the Second World War.
That sounds like science fiction to me.
In which it's perfectly real. In which surrealist creations came to life on the streets and battled the Nazis, and the resistance kind of could sometimes join up with the surrealists. So, what was the name of it, Toby? That the famous one. The man with the
Breton,
train.
The Breton one.
Yeah, what was his name, though? The Exquisite Corpse. So, surrealist creation.
So it's really lingered in your mind, though.
I'm not making it sound exciting.
Was it a good book? But that's science. Yes. How is that not science fiction? That's about an alternative reality where things are battling in a sort of...
I tell you what I think is interesting about it. Well, I think there's all sorts of interesting things about science fiction. There is two sorts, anyway, and one of them actually really thinks about what might be possible in the future. One of them just goes, imagine we could all teleport and everyone had 20 arms and you just make things up.
Isn't this famous Margaret Atwood distinction between...
It's a kind of general... Yeah. I mean, she may have talked about it.
What did she say?
Well, she described her books not as science fiction, because science fiction is concerned with stuff that is not really feasible right now, whereas her books are concerned with the kind of the beginnings of things, terrible realities, dystopian realities that are already underway.
They're kind of thought experiments, but all fiction is a thought experiment, it seems to me.
Mm. Are people who like science fiction, Lucy, and I'm sensing this, a little defensive of the subject?
I'm already feeling defensive and you haven't asked the question.
No, because I know that is my question. What? They are there's a kind of defense.
Well, that's because people are very snotty about it. But as soon as something becomes good, people don't say it's fiction anymore. It's science
but
fiction.
But Terry Pratchett kind of talks about that, about fantasy fiction as well, didn't
he?
He said that he would have won awards, the argument goes, if he'd written about a world that didn't have sort of an elephant on a turtle and witches and wizards.
Because well, surely it's all part of that general shift towards including genre fiction in a not condescending way. Fiction can be just as good as any normal fiction.
As soon as anything's good, it's described as literary fiction.
Exactly. 1984, and everyone goes, "Oh, right, that's a classic. No, that's not science fiction. That's not dystopia. That's not, you know." But it is.
So I'd make the opposite case that genre fiction is the place where the most happiness of reading can be found.
But it's
because it knows what it's aiming to do. It's aiming. This is why it's sort of postmodern fiction is such an continued kick in the shins, because it doesn't have your pleasure at its heart. It has the sort of intellectual play of the author.
It can have your pleasure at its heart. Absolutely.
Do you think?
If you
enjoy
terribly enjoyable
playful word games and playful narrative games, but that's not what your pleasure is.
Yeah, that's not why it's. I often find it's written more for the pleasure of writing than for reading. Postmodern fiction. I would, in fact, define postmodern fiction as more fun to write than to read.
Well, but that just means it's not really good.
Yeah, I think. But I think the
failure. When it's good, then it is fun.
But I think the failure rate of. Do you not think postmodern fiction failure rate is daunting high?
I think when it's done badly, it's particularly bad because there's sort of a lack of honesty to its badness. Because it always thinks it's clever.
Yeah, that's very fair. Lucy, I interrupted you. Go on. So you'd take Jennifer Howard. Is that who you're nominating?
Oh, no, I wouldn't. Okay. Boringly, that's a boring preamble.
Yeah.
No, I'd also take, because she's taking Barbara J. King's Personalities on the Plate, The Lives and Minds of the Animals We Eat,
yes.
Which I feel I ought to read, but then
we had a very
I think
nice
then
review
I wouldn't
of it.
Be able to eat anything ever again, I bet, if I read it.
There's a lot of stuff about the lives of animals. So go on, who
one
are
about
you
about octopuses who I love. Which I love? Who I love. And I don't eat them because they're so intelligent.
Really?
Seriously.
Do you eat squid? Because squid are thick.
Do you eat pork?
But octopuses.
We had a piece about that, didn't we? A few years ago.
No, I'm sure. I don't want to diss the squid, but octopuses are really intelligent.
But pigs are intelligent.
I know.
Do you eat pigs?
I've got a bit of a problem with it. And let's move on. I've got a bit of a problem with pigs.
Yeah. We may have exposed the paradox there.
I'm not 100% consistent being a human being as I am.
Okay, go on.
But the one that I would like to take, actually, is the... This sounds pretentious.
Yes.
Is the Letters of Marcel Proust to
I
his
thought
neighbour.
This was great. I thought this was great.
Because it sounds great.
Explain this. Go on. Who's that? Who's taken that?
Well, Anna Katharina Schaffner has taken it. And it's translated by Lydia Davis, who is wonderful as well.
And
so
also
I imagine the translation is wonderful.
To this feature.
Yeah, she has her own suggestions to make. And I didn't realise this, that he lived below a dentist, which must be the worst possible, like a dentist practice in Paris, must be the worst possible place to live if you are a kind of neurotic, sound-sensitive writer who stays at home all the time.
The dentist wasn't even the reason that he ended up cork-lining his room, was it? It was the other neighbour. I believe.
Is that
was
right?
It? Was yeah. it the other
I think
one?
So. I
was
think
an
there was
American lady who lived above or below him or next door.
Was the book is the letters to the French wife of an American dentist who lived above him. And it says the letters to his neighbour elevate the passive-aggressive complaint to an art form.
Yeah, I think they should come to spend a week at the TLS if they want to see the passive aggression being raised to an art form.
I don't know what stig means. Does anyone know what stig means?
I don't know who you've been talking to.
No, I don't know what
I occasionally get passive-aggressive emails about the content of the TLS.
Not from us.
Not from no.
Oh, right.
From disgruntled people.
Oh yes, yeah.
And it's always what I love about letters of complaint to the TLS is they don't get loads of them. I don't want to overstate the problem, but when a letter of complaint comes in, it says, "Why have you done this?" And then I reply very politely, and then I get a response saying, "Well, I didn't think you'd respond. Well, why did you write it then?" Of course I'm going to respond. You just said, I think your selection of this article, or if I've written it, your writing this article is substandard and you are a fool, effectively. I didn't think you'd respond. So it's a warning, if you're listening, I always respond.
He always responds politely.
I do respond politely.
No, you
well.
Do. I'm amazed at the politeness of which
Toby Lichtig. Who are you stealing from?
I was rather taken with Clive Stafford Smith's band. Mostly just because there's a really nice mix. So there's The Ice by Laleen Paul, which just looks like a good old honest dystopian sci-fi, dare I say, thriller about melting ice caps.
Don't say it. Lucy will stop throwing things at you.
I mean, it's always quite nice reading about ice when you're sitting on warm sand.
Yes, good.
There's Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, which I have never read, Stig Abel, and also, I know you're looking, Stig is looking at me like there's something deeply wrong with me, and which I actually took, I have recently been on holiday and it was the third book which I never got
to.
So I've already taken it to Spain, but it's gonna come with me on the next
jaunt.
I think it's one of the top novels of the 20th century, like up with Lolita.
It's one of my great lacunae. I don't know why I haven't read it. But
and George Berridge, who also works at the TLS, is a great McCarthy fan. He loves it.
I mean, I love Cormac McCarthy. It's just one I haven't read.
And it's the one, if you had to read one Cormac McCarthy novel, it's absurdly violent. It's very creepy. It's set in the sort of 19th century west of America. And
a lot of scalping going on.
Yeah, have you read it?
Yeah.
Did you like it?
Ears as necklaces.
Yeah, there's a lot of ears of necklaces.
Lots of beans on campfires, which is the nicer side of things.
I love a bit of it. Because when I went camping or glamping, it was glamping, it wasn't camping. But no, I took all the pretty horses because it's very fun to be camping or glamping and reading about people who actually sort of walking around in the rain. Yeah. They're not glamping.
But yeah. You wouldn't really want to be reading Blood Meridian, I don't think, if you were camping in the wild.
No. But in all the pretty horses, all you do is you pretty much eat beans for every meal and your hat gets wet. And it feels nice to be reading in comfort to that. But did you like Blood Meridian?
I did. I mean, it was years and years ago, so it's a bit... Mostly I just remember the extreme violence and the kind of aridity of it all and the heat. But very, very... Full of flourishes as well.
It's both stark
and very, you know, he'll take a sentence and all of a sudden turn it in a particular way and you'll see the horizon, the particular colours or something.
And I think he does that to a fault sometimes with Colin.
Yeah.
Because sometimes,
it makes it sort of easy to parody.
I think that's exactly, because he becomes ponderous and he becomes sort of pseudo-mystical and Blood Meridian certainly, and you saw it in the Road is a kind of attenuated version of Blood Meridian. So it's a much more restrained, because Blood Meridian is longer. There's much more colour. I mean, just from a colour point of view, The Road is basically set in a grey world of greyness, and the word grey is repeated like 400 times in the text. Blood Meridian has all of these exotic sunsets and blood, obviously red. It's got much. It's much more multicoloured. It's such an when I first read it, I just couldn't believe it. It's one of those books you put down and you just look around and sort of point. Have you seen that? It's mind.
And the character of the judge.
Yeah.
He's just one of the characters. He's so well crafted as a kind of complete evil. Yeah, I mean, frightening character.
I can't wait to go on holiday again, if only just to read Meridian.
Follow Thea. She does every month. You'll be able to.
And then the third choice in Clive Stafford Smith's selection is Tom Holland's Rubicon, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Roman Republic. And I don't read enough of this sort of thing. I don't read enough history books. Popular history. I love a bit of it. I love reading a bit about ancient Rome. You know, my day job, I read a lot of fiction and I read a lot about contemporary politics, and it's quite nice. There's something deeply escapist for me.
You should read SPQR by The Beard.
Yes, absolutely.
That's another example of that. And also his final books. We'll be able to end this part quickly because I'm agreeing with you, Toby. That's the Clive Stafford Smith is the gentleman I would mug for his baggage, because he finishes on S.J. Paris's Giordano Bruno, which is a historical fiction. He says his first love is historical fiction, and in many ways I agree with that. I read an awful lot of historical fiction, and I do like, I know it's naff, and it's the idea of these sort of pseudo detectives. So from a time before detective existed, you always got to find someone who's going to be a detective dressed in other clothes.
We were talking about the Falco books in the office the other day,
the Lindsay Davis Falco books, and that was, he was an informer, wasn't he?
Yes.
And then worked for various emperors. But she did like 15 of those books.
Yeah, they were very popular.
And they're successful.
And they're good.
And there's the other, Sansom was the other one, isn't he?
C.J. Sansom,
who did the Hunchback Lawyer books. I get the feeling, Thea, you're looking blankly at me, historical fiction?
Not so much detective fiction, a bit of, mostly the Italian stuff.
Is that good?
Some of it is very good, some of it is not.
Who would you recommend as an Italian detective?
Well, I mean, Camilleri is the kind of the Don in that respect. One book that was a sort of an Italian detective that I did really enjoy was, a few years ago, was Nicola La Gioia. It came out, and it was published by Einaudi in Italy, and then who published it here? I think it was Europa Editions, and I can't remember what its translator title was, but in Italian it was called La Ferocia, which was, I guess you would translate as The Furious.
Okay, that's a top recommendation. Lucy, you're not historical fiction. You're just a sci-fi.
No, I love
you're just pure sci-fi.
I love historical fiction. I've read A Place of Greater Safety more than once.
Did you finish it both times?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
I did.
This is the Hilary Mantel book about the French Revolution, which is
bigger than two bricks.
It's dauntingly long.
Did you ever finish Man on a Donkey? We discussed this in the podcast a few weeks ago. The greatest historical novel ever written, perhaps.
Do you know what? I've still got it on my desk, and I have not finished it. Maybe I'll take it on hold. I'll have it as one of my recommendations, what I'm going to be taking. The one book I want to just talk about, because none of us are realistically going to read it, but Hal Jensen writes for us on Bibliography very, very beautifully, and he says this as one of his summer books. This summer, I'm looking forward to the latest survey of the editorial scene by Peter Schillingsburg, Textuality and Knowledge Essays. Focused on materiality, it includes chapters on how literary works exist, the semiotics of bibliography, and long-distance revision. That is a man who loves his job.
He does indeed. He's also a fantastic theatre critic and writes you know, great fiction reviews as well.
Exactly. He's a fantastic critic of all respects. But that is a person who loves what he does.
And Peter Thoneman, who is not afraid of a busman's holiday, is going to read Iphigenia at Aulis.
Why is that, Lucy Dallas?
Because he remembers a girl who played Iphigenia who looked like Maria Callas. Yeah. Who he fell in love with.
Instantly and hopelessly in love with. Yep. It's like it's been written by a historical novelist.
And he loves a bit of Euripides.
Yeah, and he says, I can hardly wait to revisit this extraordinary play. It's enough to make you want to teach classics for a living.
Which,
you know, I like Iphigenia and Aulis a lot, but isn't
doesn't he teach classics?
He does.
That's
I think that's a knowing nod.
Yeah.
Right, we shall return to bring our own recommendations. But last week, David Grossman won the Man Booker International Prize for the year's best fiction in translation. His translator is Jessica Cohen. His book A Horse Walks Into a Bar is set around a stand-up comic's confessional routine in an Israeli comedy club. Gabriel Giuseppevici gave it a generally grudgingly admiring review in the TLS, saying, Grossman, like John Osborne, is pitch perfect, capturing the atmosphere of the cynical and vulgar New Israel to perfection. But he thinks that the book is marred, as so often in Grossman's fiction, by his need to wring the withers of his readers, by which he meant too much sentimentality for his taste. Toby here sat down with Grossman soon after his win and his translator Jessica Cohen, who is going to share the prize, £50,000 prize, with him. Toby began by asking Grossman how he felt about the win.
It's a wonderful thing. It means to get wider recognition and to have my book read by many more people. And above all, the feeling that I was understood, which is never taken for granted, not even in the Hebrew.
And Jessica?
Well, as a translator, which is kind of by definition a behind-the-scenes kind of work that tends to be in the shadows, this prize is unique in that it gives equal recognition to translators, and that is hugely significant for me, and I know for all of my fellow translators, so that really means a lot to me to be recognized in this way, and to kind of get the message out to readers who read translations that they're reading the work of two people.
And do you feel that generally and historically translators haven't been sufficiently recognised? Would you say that's a fair thing to say?
You know, it's a generalisation, but yes, on the whole, I think, you know, I still encounter a lot of people who really have no idea what it is that translators do and assume it's basically typing in another language. Obviously, there are people who understand what it means, but especially in the English-speaking world, so much of what we consume is in English that we don't stop to think about what everyone else is reading and producing and writing. And in other countries, that's not the case because they import a lot from English and it's translated, and they do have more of an awareness of what translators do.
And in this particular case, what is it that translators do in terms of your collaboration? Because obviously, David, you speak fluent English. I'm always interested in when an author has their work translated into a language they know well. So how does it actually work between you two?
I mean, as you said, David's English is excellent. It's fluent, which is both a blessing and a curse for a translator because it means I'm the only one whose work he can check up on. But it's a good thing on the whole because it does make it a collaborative process, and I'm able to get his input and his feedback and be pretty certain that I'm saying the things that he meant to say when he wrote the book. So it's always been collaborative, and it's a pleasure for me.
I never dare to doubt what Jesse is doing because, I mean, you are very generous to say I have good English, but I know it's not... I know how a good language should sound, yes, from the Hebrew. And I can just pose some questions to Jesse, asking her, are you sure that this is the right nuance of the word, the right melody of the word? But in this book and in the one that preceded it, we did something unusual. We gathered together 12 translators from different countries into a little literary translation center in the border of Germany and the Netherlands, and we worked there for a week in which I read the whole book to my translators, paragraph after paragraph, and then we all started to look for solutions to all kind of problematic places, and we noticed the differences between the different languages and the different psychology of the language and the psychology of the translator. And there were all kinds of words that there was something unclear how to translate. For example, the word ubar in Hebrew means fetus. But I think in Italian there are three, or Catalan, there are three different phases of the pregnancy of the fetus, of the embryo. So which one did I mean? They asked me. Not always I knew the answer. For me as a writer, it was a really unusual experience because I had to sit there with 12 very opinionated, critical people who knows this story not by heart, but from within the DNA of it. And they scrutinized every sentence. And I felt when we were done with it, I felt really I stood the harshest test possible for a writer. And yet I will happily do it in the next book, because when they were there, I think they were able to hear the melody with which I read and wrote. I'm reading and I have written the story. And the melody is very important, because literature is music. And every sentence has its musicality. So I was able to sing for them.
It seems like a fantastic way of doing it. Have you heard of anyone else using that process before? Or was this something you devised yourself, or you just discussed with your translators and came up with the idea together?
Both. I thought I invented it, and then I heard that once Günter Grass did it with his translators.
It completely makes sense to me, so yeah. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about the novel itself. Could you tell me a little bit about what it's about? How would you describe it?
It's a stand-up comedy session in a rundown nightclub in the city of Netanya, a small city on the shore of the Mediterranean, in Israel, of course, where the stand-upist, the comedian, Dovele Greenstein, is 57 years old. Towards the end of his career, he is bitter, he is aggressive, he is shrewd, he is vulgar. And he also is yearning for love and exposed and very vulnerable inside. And in the beginning of the book, he starts the usual tango of the performer and the audience. He teases them, he flirts with them, he insults them. They are insulting him. There is a kind of aggressive dialogue between the two parties. And in the audience, amongst all the strangers, there are two people he knew when he was a child. We do not know if both of them came voluntarily or that he invited them. There is a small lady, very small, she's a borderliner. And she didn't know even that he is the performer. But the moment he entered the stage, she is shocked because she knew him when they were children in a small neighborhood in Jerusalem. And he does not remember her. But he starts to feel that somewhere in the audience there is a focus of unaccepting him, of reluctance from him. And I think I heard it from performers that even in a crowd of 1,000 people, they spot immediately the one who is not surrendering to their charm, to their magic, to their spell. And of course, this one becomes a target. They need to convert him or her to liking them. And he starts to talk with her in his usual aggressive way until he realized that she was his neighbor in Jerusalem. And then he asked her, "What's the matter with you? Aren't my jokes good?" And she said, "No, they are evil." And then she says, "But you were a good boy." And these simple and naive, primal words, they crack him open suddenly. They touch a point in him that he cannot resist. And then suddenly the story of his childhood bursts out of him in a volcanic power that he could not control.
It's obviously an extremely moving and emotional story. Aside from your own work as a translator, Jessica, I wonder if you can just tell me how you felt as a reader with this novel.
It's a pretty draining and gut-wrenching kind of story. To me also, there's an aspect of the book that hasn't been talked about much in the reviews that I've seen that I found very compelling, which is this theme of observation. There's a lot of observing going on. I mean,
and the narrator's a judge, isn't he, which is
exactly.
Not so unimportant.
So, yeah, the book is narrated by a member of the audience who is a judge, who was a childhood friend of the comedian. The comedian calls him up and says, "I want you to come and see me." They have had no contact for decades. And he says, "I want you to watch my show." And the judge doesn't really know what's going on, but he goes and he watches. And so we have him describing his observation of the comedian and also of the audience. There's a lot of descriptions of the audience's responses and the way in which, you know, one response dictates how the rest of them respond and the ways in which they can and cannot handle what's going on stage, and some of them are so uncomfortable that they leave. And I love the descriptions of, you know, their faces and their expression and their voices and their body language as they react to what they're being told. And so I like all these levels of observing. And really, that is what a good comedian does, right? They observe human beings and they synthesize those observations into some kind of humorous take on it.
Part of the observing and looking and witnessing is a need that is expressed by the friend of Dovalet, the judge, of having a person in his life that will look at him with sympathetic eyes, who will be a sympathetic witness. And I think it's something that everyone deserves. Maybe the government should legislate a law that every citizen deserves a sympathetic witness, that, because if somebody looks at us with sympathetic eyes, he or she enables us to be better than what we are. And the opposite of sympathetic eyes is not uglifying eyes, but indifferent eyes. And I think I was privileged, and I hope many are, to be looked at with these sympathetic eyes that suddenly that formulated to me what I can be, what I never believed I can be.
Yes, I wanted to quickly ask you, Jessica, in a recent interview, you were talking about Israeli literature in translation in general, and you were saying that when it comes to Israeli literature in translation, that you don't think people are particularly interested in reading a domestic drama that happens to take place in Israel, i.e. We have a thirst to hear about the political situation and you know all the things that are going on there, as opposed to just normal family stories. And I just wondered, David, if you could talk a little bit about how you feel as an author having to deal with the political situation over there. You know, there's often, I find, with the translation, the translated Israeli fiction I read, there's often, you know, you have the Holocaust in the background, you have the occupation in the foreground. And I wonder to what extent you feel burdened by that or freighted by it yourself.
It is a burdening dimension in my life, the situation in which I live. It has affected me and my family in the worst way. I feel a need when I am facing this motionless situation and this feeling of being paralyzed, becoming indifferent, becoming cynical. All these things are things that I need to understand how they change people, and what is the way to liberate ourselves from this almost spell of doing nothing in order to change and to improve our situation. It is amazing. Israel is a country that is so daring and innovative in every walk of life, and only in the place that it's the most crucial for us, and maybe because it's the most crucial for us, we're paralyzed, we're unable to do anything. But there is not, you know, when I'm talking with right-wing people, they say, well, what are you complaining about? We have this status quo going on for 50 years since 1967, since the beginning of the occupation. And the Palestinians got used to it. From time to time, there is an eruption of violence, like those wars in Gaza. And then we go back to square one and everything is okay. I think that there cannot be status quo in a place where people are, and where subjugated and humiliated people are. It is impossible. It will erupt and explode in a much more violent way than the ones that we knew. Maybe as a writer I have this, you know, instinct, that this drive to change things, to motivate things, to generate another reality, to see the chances and the challenges in every reality, in every human condition, rather than to surrender to the obstacles and to the difficulties that exist. It is a very difficult situation. It's, I will not say desperate, because I cannot allow myself or afford myself the luxury of despair. Israel was created, and the wonderful, great idea of the creation of the State of Israel, so that we shall not be victims again. And it freaks me out to see Israel, the strong, with all its huge potential, to see it looking at itself as a passive victim of the situation, of history, of the mistakes and crimes of our partners or our enemy, I cannot accept it. I mean, we are so strong that we can afford ourselves to take the challenge and the calculated risks in order to achieve a solution, a fair solution between us and the Palestinians. They will have their independent and sovereign state as they deserve. I wish they don't live under our occupation and our pressure. I don't want to cast any shadow on them. I don't want them to cast shadow on me. And if I am occupier, I am shadowed. And I want Israel to have all the guarantees to its security and to its future. I look at my government, I look at my prime minister, I see a person who is a genius in the way he's knowing how to stir together the real dangers that Israel faces, and we do face real dangers in the Middle East, but he knows how to stir them together with the echoes of past trauma. And we, the Israelis, as a traumatized community, we are totally helpless in front of such manipulation. So against that, I think I'm rebelling with all my soul.
So would you say that the refusal of apathy in both your fiction and your political writing makes you to some extent an optimist?
Realist.
Toby Lichtig talking to David Grossman and Jessica Cohen. Toby, is this a worthy winner?
Yes, it's quite hard for me to give a full answer, given that I didn't read the entire shortlist, let alone the entire longlist. But it's an extremely powerful book.
Is it recognised as a good winner?
It is recognised as a good winner. It's a very powerful book. He is a major author. He is one of the big beasts of Israeli literature. It really is, you know, these days it's Amos Oz probably is number one, if we're going to rank them. But David,
who was also on the list.
He was also on the list for a book I didn't like very much, so I was quite glad it didn't win. Yes, Judas, it was called.
What was wrong with it?
I prefer Grossman's book. And yeah, Grossman's probably the number two, and he's... But I think he's possibly even a better writer. He can be sentimental. I've read a few of his books, and maybe sentimental is not quite the right word. He definitely lays it on thick, but he deals with very, very big and weighty themes.
What was wrong with the Oz book?
The Amos Oz book, it was incredibly schematic. It was a book about Israel through the character of a man who has to kind of grapple with his beliefs in God and sort of vary, you know, the various tropes like Jerusalem stood for the old and Tel Aviv stood for the new, and it just you just sort of felt there was no real need for it.
Is Israel, I was thinking about this, there's a period of South African fiction where every time you read a book set in South Africa, the character of South Africa was like the most dominant character. You know, if it's a book in South Africa, it was about South Africa.
Absolutely.
Is the same true of Israel?
It's often true, but it's also often true of the books from Israel that we get in translation. Now, I'm sure there are many, many books published in Israel in Hebrew that have absolutely nothing to do with, for example, the Palestinian conflict or the state of Israel and the state of the nation. But I think the stuff that publishers probably rightly believe is going to get read over in England and America is the more kind of weighty state of the nation stuff. So it's more a facet of what gets translated, I think.
It'd be nice in a way to have a novel, an Israeli novel, winning something that was just a novel about human life that wasn't necessarily focused on the politics.
Absolutely, and I think Grossman's novel is to a certain extent. I mean, it's got various strands to it, but yeah, it's not just a novel about politics.
And do we think this, just finally before we go to the summer books, this is an important prize? It's a worthy prize.
The Man Booker International. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. In many ways, I think it's more interesting and exciting than the Man Booker itself. I mean, you know, you've got all the countries of the world that don't speak English. That's quite a few of them. And again, the sorts of books that tend to get translated are often better than books that just get, you know, published, run-of-the-mill books.
And the translators get some of the money,
crucially. It's fantastic that the translators get some of the money. This only started last year, so it's an amalgamation of what used to be the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize and a Man Booker International Prize. So they changed the format, and in the new format, there's £50,000, you said, which is split between £25,000 each, the translator, and the author, him or herself, which is great because translators often don't get recognition or sufficient recognition, and it's fantastic for the whole industry.
And they often don't get the cash.
So it's, I mean, Jessica Cohen was rightly delighted.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay then, so back to our summer books issue. Time for everyone to tell us what books they will be taking on holiday or another holiday if you're Thea this year. Points will be deducted for virtue signalling and evident fabrications. Toby Lishday, I'm looking at you in terms of the over-literary recommendations for historical fiction last time you were on.
War and Peace,
Sorry, everyone. Thea.
Well, I already told you what I did take.
Yeah, so we need to be future-looking.
So I can tell you that was very, very good.
Yes.
What I'm currently reading is a book. Well, both of them came out a couple of years ago.
That's okay.
Because I think summer books is a time for catching up.
Indeed. And by TLS standards, a couple of years ago is not old.
Well, exactly. I've got The End of Absence by Michael Harris. Okay. The subtitle is Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection, which okay. is That's a terrible, fun. Terrible yeah. subtitle. But it's basically, I'm reading it alongside a collection of essays by Rebecca Solnit called Encyclopedia of Trouble and Spaciousness, which collects essays, well-known ones by her and lesser-known ones, which kind of range from studies of the water, the politics of water in the west of America, to accompanying her on a trip that she took to the Arctic with a bunch of other writers and scientists and so on. And it's basically because at the moment I'm really obsessed with this notion of space and solitude. Okay. So that I'm sort of reading them alongside each
and you're
other.
A fan of the essay form, aren't you?
I am, yes.
And you think? Do you think Solnit is a fine proponent of that?
I do.
Didion for our time.
Yes, but also very, very different to Didion. Although she does, well, I would say what Solnit excels in is she creates unusual connections. She connects things that you wouldn't necessarily think of connecting, and she's also not afraid to, you know, work within the essay form but completely take it apart. So one of the first essays, in inverted commas, in the collection that I've mentioned is called, I think it's called Cyclopedia of Arctic Exploration. And so you get it's exactly that. It's sort of like a dictionary of it, really. So you've okay. got the first entry, which is Anchor Chain. And so she says, the hideous booming clatter that awoke me on our first morning out. The chains were huge beasts in the stern of the boat that rattled like the end of the world. And then she runs through, you know, pages and pages, and then you get to Zodiac, which is a black rubber raft used for all landings in the wild. A rubber ring as black as the night bearing the Arctic Zodiac, in which the constellations are different, and one is born under the sign of the fox, walrus, ring seal, whale, polar bear, reindeer, pink jellyfish, ivory gull, spiral snail, scurvy grass, cod, and mosquito. So she has a lyrical quality to yeah. her writing, and I think what works very well in her collections of essays is that you'll get something like that, just before you get a really good investigative piece about the historical politics of water, as I mentioned, in the American West.
So it's not just sort of exuberant style. There's a sort of
you get
to
both.
So there you recommend. That's right. We've got an essay actually in the paper next week by Lamorna Ash, one of our own, who's spent a week on a Cornish deep sea trawler. It's
fantastic,
so lovely.
Fantastic piece of writing.
And it's just a nice thing. So I think the essay form, we talked about it, was it last week or the week before? Was it
week before last?
Week before, because you were here, and it was
Brian Dillon.
And I think, is there a resurgence of the form? If you're recommending
on this side of the Atlantic, I mean, it never sort of went anywhere in America.
Yeah.
They've always been
suddenly
so
got,
great.
It's finally got trendy here, hasn't it?
Yeah, so a lot of books that were published in America a couple of years ago, like with Eula Biss's Notes from No Man's Land, for example, that's only now coming over and being published in the UK.
Yeah.
So that is, I think that does reflect a...
It's on the way, yeah. How interesting. Lucy, what are you going to take?
Well, I'm not really sure. I haven't got a holiday planned. I know, I have thought about it. I'm literally just thinking about it for the first time now. No, I'm not. I thought
Lucy's just Googling as we're talking.
I would,
books.
But there's no connection.
Yeah.
I haven't got a holiday planned, and I thought, oh, I don't know what I'm going to read. But actually, what I am reading at the moment, does that count?
Yeah, that's fine.
And I did have it when I was last away for one day.
This is
it's a book I tried to steal from Thea, and she rightly wouldn't let me because she was sending it off for review to someone else.
That's
so
fair.
I had to buy it.
That's good professionalism from Thea. What is it?
It's, I don't know what the name of it is. Yes, I do. Gastronomical Me by M.F.K. Fisher, which is, they're like little essays or vignettes.
They're beautifully produced, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a lovely book. The foreword is by our own B. Wilson. And in fact, she mentions it when she's talking about her summer books. And it sounds as though it's just about all the dinners she's had, but it's not at all.
And who is this person, Fisher?
She's like, who is she?
Well, Thea? I mean, she's very well known in America. She's one of the doyens of well, I was going to say of food writing, but just of writing. John Updike said she was the poet of the appetites. W.H. Auden said she was, I think, the best prose stylist in America.
That's what it says on that book. It just says there's no one writing better prose than this.
And she's somehow never really been received as highly.
I think it's because we don't really trust people who like food either a bit. We think it's a bit...
Well, because in England, food has been so terrible for so long that people probably couldn't understand why anyone would want to write about food.
But then, did she write about anything other than food?
Absolutely. I mean, she writes about all sorts of things, but she also happens to tell you about the meals. But she writes about her childhood.
She writes beautifully about her childhood.
Yeah, really lovely. And then she goes to France with her husband when they're young in the 30s. And it's just so different. They have kind of all sorts of awakenings. And one of them is about food and wine, but it's obviously not just that. And it's not the kind of... She's not telling you how she feels constantly. In fact, she hardly ever tells you how she feels.
Quite right, too.
Exactly. I'm absolutely with that.
None of that.
But there are all sorts of impressions and observations and stories. It's really, really beautifully done.
That's what you are reading and what you'd recommend for people to read.
That's one of the things I would recommend, yeah.
Okay.
A review forthcoming in the TLS.
Hey.
Not by
that's
me.
That's why I deprived you of them.
Who's she wouldn't give me the book.
Rebecca May Johnson.
Oh, lovely. There we go. That'll be forthcoming, will it?
Yes.
Excellent. Right then, Toby.
Well, apart from Blood Meridian, which we have discussed,
yes.
I'm going to be
War
taking...
War and Peace?
War and Peace. I always take that on holiday. Yeah. I'm going to be taking A Sport and a Pastime by James Salter. And the reason is, American author James Salter, on the holiday that I've just been on, during which I failed to get a tan, I read James Salter's last novel, which is called All That Is, not to be confused with David Zoloy's All That Man Is, which Thea's just read, which he wrote maybe 3 or 4 years ago, just before he died in his late 80s. So, you know, he wrote it at a grand old age. I've been meaning to read it for years.
And who is he? Tell us who James Salter is. Because he's almost a kind of forgotten man of American letters, in a way, he's basically a
good old-fashioned great American novelist.
Yeah.
He's a contemporary of John Updike and various other sort of big beasts of American letters. He never really got quite the recognition that the Updikes and the Mailers, for example, did, although he wrote about similar things, partly because he wasn't quite as prolific, partly because he wrote screenplays as well, and partly because perhaps he just wasn't liked as much. But I think he's absolutely brilliant. All That is a superb
novel. I've never read any of him, and I love great American
I think you'd love him. Sport and Pastime was published in 1967, so it's 50 years old, and it deals with love and marriage and sex and success and career and various other big themes. He was also a fighter pilot for 12 years, I believe, and he fought in the Korean War. He started off in the Second World War and then went on and served during the Korean War. So he deals with those kind of themes as well. Quite a muscular style.
So quite
very blokey.
Quite a bloke.
Very blokey.
And that's a grand tradition of that. Mailer, not least.
Exactly.
Did Mailer like him? I think he did.
And Richard Ford, I think he's Richard Ford's favourite novelist, says no one writes better than James Salter.
And is there many in the canon?
There are maybe 7 or 8 novels. There's a memoir. And like I say, there are a few screenplays. But it's A Sport and a Pastime. It's supposed to be his best novel. In a way, I've started off in a strange way because I've read his final book and nothing else. But I'm quite excited to read this one.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Anything else? Is that your one?
Well, no.
There's a pile of books tottering in the corner.
There's a pile of books. There's this book by Vivek Shanbhag called Gacha Gotcha. I probably pronounced that wrong. It is translated from the Kannada.
Who of us here can say they haven't read this? Actually,
well, Toby's got my version.
That's right. Yes. If I look inside, will it say Lucy Dallas was here?
So he's an Indian novelist. There's some interesting Indian fiction around at the moment.
Yes.
Neil Mukherjee's A State of Freedom, which we've just extracted in the paper.
Which you love.
Which I love and is wonderful.
And it's why we're extracting, because you pretty much read it and you thought, we have to.
We have to. Aaron Dessie Roy's new novel came out a couple of weeks ago.
Which people have liked,
which people have liked.
The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, is that it?
The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, which is a kind of annoying title, but it sounds very, very good.
Did you read the interview with her in The Guardian?
It's unbelievably annoying.
Did you not know,
this
extraordinary anecdote?
Didn't reach me in Sardinia.
Yeah, this is Decca Aitkenhead, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And she said, when...
He's a great interviewer.
She is a great interviewer. And she plays this completely po-faced and straight. So I'll try to do the same. So Aaron Dessie Roy, when she'd written this book, obviously there'd been a period where she hadn't written for a while, and she said to her agent, we need to auction this, but we're not going to auction this for money. I want every publisher to write me a letter as to why they should publish it. And then the letters come in, and then she said, I now need to consult the characters of the book.
I've heard about this.
To see whether, who should
whether they would allow me.
And purportedly, she went with someone for less money because the characters wanted it. Right. And I emailed an agent a copy of this article and said, that's a funny way of doing it. And the agent said, I know her agent, and there's no way he'd have put up with that. But who knows? Anyway, so that was the anecdote of the... But it's a good book. Terrible anecdote.
So Mukherjee and Roy, they're the sort of the two big Indian novels of the summer. But everyone's been... Well, not everyone. Quite a few people have been telling me that this... this
it's Gatcha short, Gotcha isn't it? It has
the appeal of being extremely short as well. That's going to be... complete my trilogy of Indian novels this summer.
That's great. Well, okay, well, I'll do mine. And then I'm going to ask you how many books you actually take when you go on holiday. Because I always take a ridiculous sort of lumpy bag full of the sort of fear of not having books. I'm going to be reading Patrick O'Brien, the naval historical novelist, which...
Hornblower Ahoy.
Yeah, but he's even more salty sea dog than Hornblower.
Which seas is
he moving in?
All over the place.
All seven of the seas.
Yeah, all seven of the seven seas. It's Napoleonic. But people have always been said to me, I found the first book in the series, Master and Commander, which was made a film with...
It's very good, isn't it, Master and Commander?
The book. I'm reading the book at the minute, and the film is got Russell Crowe as Jack Aubrey. And so the book, this guy sent it to me and said, oh, you now can read this 7,000-word super novel because there's 22 books in it. So I read it, and I didn't really have time to think about it. So I started it again, so I'm going to try and get into Patrick O'Brien this summer. I'm going to reread Pride and Prejudice because it's the 200th anniversary. I do more or less read it every year, and we've got a special book of Jane Austen coming out, TLS publishing all its old material around it, which made me sort of consider my favourite Jane Austen novels, which begins with Pride and Prejudice as my favourite. Lucy, you look slightly downcast at the prospect of Jane Austen.
No, not at all. No. But I wouldn't have Pride and Prejudice.
What's your favourite?
I think I'd say Emma.
Really? So I don't like Emma the person.
Well, but it's not exactly that you like her. I agree that... they're more likeable in Pride and Prejudice, some of them.
You're going for Emma. Thea?
I quite like Mansfield Park.
Yeah.
But
I do also quite like Northanger Abbey.
Really?
Yeah,
the
I mean, talking about genre
novel.
Fiction, and I do quite enjoy that.
So I'm going to read Pride and Prejudice. And Lucy, we had a conversation about P.G. Woodhouse, which, as you know, I read it every day.
I was going to say later on, can I say what I'm really taking as well?
is it P.G. Woodhouse?
I'm definitely taking the Beano. But realistically, I'm going to take some Woodhouse.
So where did you get to on P.G. Woodhouse?
So what I did is I read lots of Jeeves and Wooster, which is wonderful. And then I sort of didn't want to read anything else in case it wasn't as good.
Yeah.
And then I read a bit of Blandings, which was wonderful. And then by accident, as we discussed, I read the last Smith one.
Leave It to Smith.
Which is set in
Blandings.
That's why I read it in the wrong order, because it's set in Blandings.
And he's just the most wonderful creation.
I loved him so much.
Literature.
Then I thought, I want to read everything that he's in.
So what have you read thus far?
I haven't yet, so I'm still on the last one, and I'm going to work back and do it in the right order.
So you're going to start. So the first one is Mike and Smith, which is a schoolboy tale.
I read that when I was a kid.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
Which is fantastic, but it's
12-year-olds.
That's all
which
right.
is fine.
But the book I'm going to reread over the summer is the greatest Smith book, which is called Smith Journalist. And he goes to New York with Mike on a cricket tour, and he obviously not plays cricket, so he takes over a magazine called Cozy Moments, which is for middle-class people in America and has things about sort of lessons for the nursery. And he turns it into a campaigning newspaper that stops slum landlords. And it's this incredible Woodhouse novel because it's got a depiction of a boxing match. It's got fights with gangsters. And all the way through it, there's this imperturbable vision of Smith with his monocle going through New York streets, fairly shady New York streets fighting gangsters.
As a muckraker journalist.
As a muckraker journalist in the grand tradition of journalism. Some great things about journalism in it as well. Anyone who's involved in journalism loves it. It's the great journalistic... Everyone says Scoop is the great journalistic
Scoop
novel.
I think is a little bit overrated.
I think it is overrated. And I think Smith Journalist is the great journalist novel. So you've got so much pleasure ahead of you because the Smith Journalist... And what's the other Smith one? Smith in the City, yeah, where he goes and works in a bank, which P.G. Yeah. Woodhouse did before he became a writer.
Cozy Moments, I think you should consider changing the name of the TLS to Cozy Moments. The other thing that I genuinely did want
be
to read...
It's misleading.
But that's all right, people get used to it.
Yeah.
From the archives this week, when we've got this brilliant piece written in 1902 by someone who tells you what to read in 1902, it's brilliant.
Oh,
brilliant
on a train,
thing.
What yeah. to read on a train. It's a good idea.
Well, he basically says don't read. Unless you can't help it and you're a bookworm, don't read, sleep or eat. And then he says... But if
you see why this is attractive to you, Lucy.
I read it though. Yeah. It says, more often than not, your fellow passenger will be content with one of these amazing publications, Comic Cagmag, which sounds quite good, yeah. or Hoity Toity Bits. Nearly as good as Cozy Moments.
What, there's a magazine called Hoity Toity Bits?
Well, I don't know whether it was real or whether he's made it up, but it doesn't matter.
That sounds like it would be an entirely disreputable magazine called Hoity Toity Bits,
I think,
to be honest.
If you were reading Cozy Moments and like Hoity Toity Bits, yeah. they might cancel
It's like a version of Reader's Wives, is it?
No.
Upper class Reader's Wives. Hoity Toity Bits, no?
That's what
Always
I'd like
Always highbrow at the TLS.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
I'm just bringing the tone down.
Have you ever, before we go, one of the pleasures I find of going on holiday, particularly if you stay in a house, is... picking up a book that's already there and discovering an author that way. Has that ever happened to you? I did it a couple of years ago. I've told Toby about this because I've recommended the Modesty Blaise novels. I was in a place in Kent and there was this sort of slightly water-damaged Modesty Blaise novel by Peter O'Donnell, I think his name is, these sort of 70s schlock genre novels.
Is that the one where she's a woman, isn't she? She's just sort of... Yeah, and don't her clothes fall off
She
all
takes
the time.
Her clothes off. It's this
she
weird,
takes them off.
Yeah, it's this weird combination of a...
They're all
70s,
laughing, but it's true.
Yeah, it's true. It's a weird combination of sort of 70s
hoity
schlock.
Hoity-toity bits.
Yeah. It's not that hoity-toity, actually, no.
But it's oddly, there's a sort of feminist strain running through it as well, because it's not very... She is the dominant, strong character. She's not sexualized really, in any way, despite often being naked. She has this friendship with a guy called Willie. But they have this amazing platonic relationship, and it's very schlocky. But anyway, I found it. I'd never heard of it, and I read it, and then I read all seven of them. I'm trying to foist them on Toby at the minute. After Blood Meridian.
Toby's too busy reading them things in the original.
Yeah, exactly. He's reading them in the original Sanskrit. Now, have we got... has that ever happened to you? Have you ever found an author that way?
I love reading the first three pages of novels. So even if I've got three books in my suitcase and I'm staying somewhere, I will wander around the library, however meagre it is.
Because
even if it's three books, you know, sitting by the toilet or whatever, and I like to start things just to get a flavour of them.
To see what it'd be like. Because there's people here who are taking, you know, relatively cerebral books, and you just wonder that when they get on holiday and there's a tattered version of the Da Vinci Code... How many of them go, oh, I'm going to just have a look at it.
I'm going to read Herodotus in a minute, but first...
Yeah. There is a pleasure in the good, bad book, isn't there?
Loads of pleasure, yeah. I read John le Carré. Not that that's a good, bad book. I think they're just good, aren't they? But it was a bit of a downer, I have to say.
Which one did you read?
Oh, I can't remember.
Last year I took...
A smiley one?
Yeah.
In which things are a bit miserable and someone gets tortured?
Well, it could be any of them, but Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy has that in.
There's a new Smiley novel out this
There
September.
Is. Will that be any good?
I have no idea.
What's his last?
I think the previous one was An Indelicate Truth, which we gave a right old TLS drubbing.
Did we?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
See, I read it when...
Find that in the archive.
Yes.
Very, very, very funny pieces by Frederick Raphael. I recommend it.
Oh, really? Because I read Tinker Tailor when I was a kid, like too young. And because it was a sort of in a house filled with Len Deighton and sort of those sort of 70s crap that I had in my house, it was kind of the elevated version of that. And I read it and I suppose didn't really fully understand. I reread it last year on holiday. I think that's a great holiday book.
It is quite good, but I was looking for something light. And, you know, someone ended up really being tortured in a kind of Eastern German camp somewhere. So, yeah. No, it was gripping.
So cheer us up there, Lucy. On that cheery note, if you want to read...
I gave you two alternative names for the TLS.
Yes. Well,
Cozy Moments.
And...
Hoity-toity Bits.
Hoity-toity Bits. That's all we have time for this week. It's a good name for the podcast. You know, we've already got quite a weird name for the podcast. Hoity-toity Bits could also work. The spin-off show.
The more salacious younger sister.
Yeah, the late night version.
Late women's hour. You know.
It is late, yeah.
Yeah,
is that any good?
Late night women's hour. It is quite good, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, presented by Lauren Laverne. Mm.
Could they call that hoity-toity bits? Could anything? I mean, because now you say it, virtually anything would be improved by being called hoity-toity bits.
That's my thesis.
If we've learnt anything today, and I think we have, that is really what we've learnt.
We hope you enjoyed this trip down memory lane. We'll be back with new weekly episodes from September the 10th. Till then, head to the website, the-tls.co.uk, to keep up with the weekly magazine.